It's time for the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pins the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine. Get your questions ready in our live chat or call in to 971-533-7111 now.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Time for our live cannabis community chat with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. You can also call toll-free at 844-207-2346. That's 84-420-RADIO. And hi, Dr. Mitch, how you doing?
Having a great day.
I'm having a great day, too. Got back from the Seattle Hemp Fest. Got a little less sun than I usually get because it rained two of the 3 days. So I guess that's my harm reduction, is to hope that it rains. We've got some great questions here because we've been off for a couple of weeks and a lot of different studies have piled up for us to talk about. And we're also taking a look at the chat room in case anybody gets any questions in there. I thought maybe we'd start with the one that's kind of fun, and that's Shakespeare. Might have been a weed smoker. Tell folks about this one.
It's funny because the original finding came out over a year ago. They discovered some pipes in a place where he lived. And now they've actually gone ahead and taken a closer look at some of those residues, and there really are cannabinoids in there. And so it seems pretty obvious that Shakespeare at least owned a pipe that marijuana was smoked from. So when you think about medicinal uses back at the time, not a lot of folks were actually smoking. They were more tincture and just edibles more generally. So this is a bit of a novelty, and I got to hand it to the bard. He can string some words together in unusual ways, and they might have given him the schizotypy diagnosis and blamed it on marijuana back then.
No kidding. I mean, this is very confusing because Kevin Sabet always told me that pot smoking is a relatively new phenomenon, no cultural backing for it. But what, the bard, we're talking, what, 16th century?
Yeah, so, you know, he was baptized in 1564, apparently, and... you know, made it to the 1600s. But in fact, when you look at some of the stuff from Africa, too, they used to make a little bowl right in the ground and kind of drill a hole in the ground and smoke probably as early as the 1300s. So poor Kevin needs to take a closer look at those data.
And what else? Didn't they find some other things, some coca in some of the other pipes?
Yeah, and it's funny because the coca leaves seemed more popular, which I guess I shouldn't be so surprised, but the actual smoking of coca seems like a poor use of it. It's not really all that bioavailable once you light it on fire that way. It's not like crack where it's already been turned into a precipitate like that, so I can't imagine it was particularly efficient, and it probably would have been better for them to just put a little pinch between the cheek and gum.
Yeah, there you go. We had a question from our chat room. John Thomas wants to know if marijuana can help with Mexican dysentery. He's back from a trip, you see.
So what's funny is Shenang used to prescribe it back in 2800 BC, but I think it's more for just calming the ills and the horrible, you know, fatigue feeling, and you do a whole lot better with some of the standard caopectate type interventions.
There we go. All right. So let's get to this study. There's been a few of them that have come out, and this one is very interesting about teen marijuana use. All the time we've heard, what about the children? And the worst possible thing is adolescent boys smoking pot because they're vulnerable to schizophrenia, and they're going to lose cognition, and their IQ is going to go down, and they're going to get lung cancer, and they're going to get depressed and anxiety. And it's always about those adolescent chronic users. Tell us about this latest study on teen use and later health outcomes.
This is an intriguing crew at University of Pittsburgh now, and I actually had one of the same team on my podcast, if people want to check it out, at Cannabis Radio. But essentially what's happened is they've got a relatively large sample here, over 400 folks, and they've tracked them really closely on a whole lot of dependent measures that are the things that are sort of at the forefront of all the controversy, and found literally effects that are just absolutely negligible on all the psychotic symptoms, on cancer, on asthma, on respiratory problems. It just really wasn't there. And I mean, these weren't incredibly heavy users or anything like that, but it certainly suggests that we might do better to focus more on preventing alcohol problems in teens than the spending all this time vilifying cannabis.
But to be clear, it wasn't like heavy duty wake and bake everyday teenage smokers we're talking about.
Not at all. But in fact, those are incredibly rare. So even the chronic users, you know, it wasn't like they were smoking every day. And it's actually pretty hard to find those folks. And I think that says something about sort of the natural feel that you have when you're, you know, when you're a 14-year-old, you realize, wow, I can't quite pull this off getting high all day, every day. And I think that we can trust teens to actually be relatively well-informed. And it's a very small subset of folks who actually run into troubles. We do, you know, have concerns about brain development, and, you know, normal's never going to say, oh, it's fine to smoke when you're a teen, but I think it's not the outrageous horror that we were once led to believe.
All right. Now, on the other side of the coin, we get a study that comes out suggesting that there's a link between the number of pot shops you have in your zip code and the number of marijuana-related hospitalizations you have in your zip code. I'll just let you tear this one down.
Well, I mean, what's funny is everybody who's listened to us for more than a week knows about random assignment. And the problem is, pot shops aren't randomly assigned to zip code areas, and they try to control for it. If you look at the original abstract, they said, well, when we took a zip code neighboring, you know, and tried to compare it to that. But that really means nothing. You can think about literally the classic 90210 in Los Angeles is right next to 90200. You know, it's just not the kind of thing where this is a reasonable control. So what they're really saying is, hey, guess what? In bad neighborhoods, there are more pot-related hospitalizations. Oh, and coincidentally, a lot of dispensaries end up in those. I think it says more about our unwillingness to let good medical marijuana dispensaries show up. I mean, I'd love to have one next door to me. And I think it would be a lot nicer for us to, you know, understand that this kind of business is a valid business and should be spread out so that people can have an easy time finding them, not suddenly vilifying them simply because they do end up often in bad neighborhoods.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of NIMBYism when we end up legalizing. They always want to, you know, zone the pot shops way out into some industrial district, and, you know, they're redlined into these few little very economically depressed areas, and, you know, surprise, surprise, people probably go to the hospital for everything more in those areas.
I sure would have liked to have seen that control, and I'm lamenting this right now because, you know, New York's medical cannabis is basically going to be 20 shops for a state of 20 million people, and I just can't imagine they're going to end up put anywhere that's necessarily convenient for everybody, and certainly not in consideration of crime.
Yeah. All right. So more on the good news side of studies. Paolo Montano published this in the Normal blog about cannabis users being less likely to be obese and possessing lower diabetes risk. And, you know, I heard Keith Straub speaking this weekend at Seattle Hemp Fest, and he spoke about his use of cannabis and how in his 60s he ended up getting these seizures. And he asked Dr. Lester Grinspoon about it, and he said, Keith, you'd probably always had seizures except you've been high for 40 years. And I'm wondering with myself,
I would have had them probably had an onset a lot earlier in life under the circumstances. And you watch him respond to cannabis, and it's a lot like some of those things you've seen with folks with cerebral palsy, where, you know, you literally can see Keith take a hit and have the tremor decrease.
Yeah.
These data are really a replication of, you know, things we've seen at least in two other data sets, where the average BMI of the folks who are cannabis users is significantly smaller than for the non-user. Now we're talking, you know, a couple of BMI points, which is, you know, a lot of pounds per meter of height, so to speak. And of course, then it also seems to translate to a lower prevalence of type 2 diabetes, and that's the one when you think of folks who've, you know, just been eating really inappropriately and in large amounts. And it so defies that munchy stereotype. I think, in fact, a lot of cannabis users happen to be appreciative of plants and mindful of their diets, and it all seems to pay off. But there's this tacit assumption that there's a certain amount of pleasure you need in your day, and folks who are willing to get it from one smokable plant may not be quick to run to try to get it just from food.
You know, I shuddered to think, you know, I just went to the doctor and I got a little diagnosis of being pre-diabetic. It runs in my family, type 2 on my mom and my dad's side. And I shudder to think if I hadn't been smoking pot all this time, where I might be at this point. But better, greener foods in my future and more time on the bike, that's for sure. Let's get this last one in. This is from multiple sclerosis patients. CBS MarketWatch talking about them finding relief in a marijuana chewing gum. Now, it seems to me that wouldn't be as effective as something inhaled, but what can you tell us about this?
What's intriguing is the idea is great because you could have a sort of therapeutic dose in your system all the time, without having to smoke, but it's a kind of ridiculous extra step to make folks have to chew gum. And the gum that they're talking about is 5-milligram cannabidiol gum. We've seen some problems with some reports on some business sources of that, and you know, I don't want to get sucked all into that, but the idea that CBD could help folks with MS is pretty well documented now. I would just as soon see folks getting a standardized dose through smoked cannabis just so they can keep a steady state without having to go through all this complicated formation of the gum. But they're suggesting that physicians really like this idea of, hey, we know it's 5 milligrams of THC, we know how much cannabidiol is in there. We can show them how to chew it. They don't have to worry about smoking. If that's what they want, more power to them. It just seems like an awful lot of extra work for something that we already have pretty easy access to.
All right, folks. Well, that's about the time we got for our questions. If you have one you want to get in by email, you can always send it to 420research@gmail.com. That's 420research@gmail.com. And as we go out in this last minute, Dr. Mitch, I just wanted to get your take on a non-marijuana related story. And that was the announcement by the Food and Drug Administration that OxyContin is now approved for ages 11 to 16.
I'm super apprehensive about it, but I can certainly understand situations where for short-term pain relief, that's okay. But the irony that they also can't have access to, say, high cannabidiol strains when they have seizures really breaks my heart.
Yeah, it seems pretty unnecessary, and a lot of people were talking about this at Seattle Hemp Fest this weekend, with the shock being, you know, that juxtaposition. It's like, wait a minute, you're going to approve Oxy for 11-year-olds, but this girl in New Jersey is fighting to use, she's highly epileptic, fighting to be able to use a non-psychoactive cannabidiol oil at school, and they wouldn't even let a parent or guardian take her off campus in the middle of the day to give her the cannabidiol oil. But by God, if she needed some Oxy, she'd be okay.
I mean, that is just completely hypocritical and ridiculous.
Yeah. All right. Hey, folks, make sure you check out Dr. Mitch's podcast on cannabisradio.com. Is it got a particular title, Dr. Mitch?
So that one's on my show, Burning Issues, and I believe it just mentions adolescence in the title. I can't remember it word for word.
Okay, check that out, cannabisradio.com, and we'll be talking with the folks at cannabisradio.com very soon. Might end up having this show joining you there, Dr. Mitch.
That'd be super.
That'd be awesome. I would love it. All right, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week, and have yourself a great day.
You too.
All right. When we come back, we got more highlights from the Seattle Hemp Fest, my speech from the main stage on how the no on I-502 people were wrong.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
Hey everybody, it's Radical Russ here from 420 Radio, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.